NPR's Allison Keyes reports number one seed Roger Federer is hoping to reclaim the title he last won in 2008.
Federer only reached the semifinals last year, but the five-time champion says this time around he feels like it's going to take something special for his opponent to win. The 31-year-old won his seventh Wimbledon crown this year, his 17th Grand Slam title. On the women's side, the defending champion, Samantha Stosur, says Williams is probably the favorite given her recent victories at Wimbledon and the Olympics. But Williams says you have to embrace it whether you're the favorite or not, and she's hoping to do her best in this, the final Grand Slam of the year. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who believes smart listening and smart banking go together. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In this hour of the program, we'll be exploring some of the problems, politics, and policies of energy in America. And our guest for the program is Michael Gretz. And we will talk about some of what you will find in his book, The End of Energy. The subtitle is The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. The book is published by the MIT Press. Our guest, Michael Gretz, is a professor at Columbia University. He's professor of tax law at Columbia University. He's also emeritus professor of law at Yale Law School and is a specialist in tax law. We'll be talking about some of the ideas in his book. It takes a look at the major forms of energy that we use: coal, oil, nuclear, green alternatives, and makes the argument that government has never really tried to control them very well, or at least the attempts to control them have not been very effective. They certainly, he argues, haven't served the needs of the American people, have not served the environment well. In fact, he says the government has never really demanded that Americans pay the full cost of the energy they use. And as a result, we expect that energy is cheap and will be cheap and will always be available. And Professor Gretz, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. You know, as I mentioned, your particular area of interest and expertise is tax law. So perhaps I would begin by asking why a tax guy would decide that he would want to take on energy policy.
Well, it's interesting. I was actually involved in a seminar for a number of years with a historian who's a longtime colleague and friend of mine, in which we began teaching about the changes that happened to America in the 1970s. That was about 5 or 6 years ago. And when you look at the changes that happened in the 1970s, one of the major ones was that rather than being the world's exporter of energy and self-reliant, our country changed to being dependent on the Middle East, in particular, the OPEC countries. And I then spent the last 5 years learning about energy policy because I was puzzled as to why we had obviously failed so in our policy prescriptions.
Mm-hmm. You, I think you make the argument that so much of the conventional wisdom about energy policy, why it is that we don't have a policy that is more coherent and more effective. I think you make the argument that the things, the commonplace things that people say, generally speaking, are wrong. They like to blame presidential leadership or lack of it. They like to blame partisan infighting. But you say that while those two things may play a role, they're maybe not as important as people think.
Well, that's right. You know, we've had eight presidents, beginning with Richard Nixon through Barack Obama. All of them have actually tried to do something important in the energy area. It's not a failure of leadership. They've all tried to lead. One of the problems is that each of the presidents, I think it's fair to say, has seemed to think that there's some technological silver bullet right around the corner. Mm-hmm. Or they've become obsessed with one particular form of energy and decided that's what's going to solve our problems. So for Richard Nixon, it was the nuclear breeder reactor, which was going to produce its own nuclear fuel. And for Jimmy Carter, it was something called SynFuels, which was an idea of converting coal, which of course is abundant in the United States, into a liquid fuel that could be used to run our gas, to fuel our trucks and cars. And so everybody sort of focuses on one particular thing. We've wasted a huge amount of money looking for the silver bullet, and our energy research programs have suffered as a result. So, for example, in the 70s, we were way ahead of the rest of the world on solar energy, but we sort of took our eye off that ball, and others have passed us since. Mm. And on the partisanship point, and I think this is important because people now, I think, properly lament the bitter partisanship that we see in Washington day after day. And the thought is, well, if we only would go back to the good old days, say the 1970s or so, or 80s even, when the parties were able to work across the aisle and accomplish something, then we'd be in much better shape. But in the energy area, the problem is really not so much partisan politics as it is an effort to protect regional interests. So let me give you an example or two, so mm-hmm. a recent example or two. So in recent months, Tom Coburn from Oklahoma has suggested, I believe quite correctly, that we ought to eliminate large subsidies for ethanol production, which we've had for many years. And, you know, when you go to the gas tank and fill up your tank, it's 10% ethanol. This has driven up the price of corn. It's made large agribusinesses very wealthy and some other large businesses. And in any event, I think it's widely conceded by people who have studied it that these subsidies are wasteful and inappropriate. Well, Tim Harkin, who is a senator from Iowa and a liberal Democrat, and Charles Grassley, who is a senator from Iowa and a conservative Republican, both agreed that this would not be smart to repeal these subsidies for corn because the corn grows well in Iowa. And so while they don't agree on much in terms of public policy, they certainly agreed on retaining ethanol subsidies. And Grassley suggested to his Republican colleague, who he agrees with on most things, from Oklahoma, that maybe we ought to be repealing the oil and gas subsidies. And needless to say, the Oklahoma senator didn't find that a terribly congenial idea. So that what we see is we see huge efforts to protect regional interests, particularly in the Congress. Eastern coal interests have been tremendously effective over the years in acquiring subsidies and making sure that coal does not pay the costs of the health and pollution that it health injuries and pollution that it causes. And as a result, we either end up stalemating or we end up giving away money to everybody. And that's not a bad summary of our energy policy.
Mm. Well, it seems that there, again, here are two major points. One is, and I think that you can, this is true not just when it comes to energy policy, but when it comes to many different kinds of policy. Here in the United States, there's the potential for the change of the person in the White House every 4 years, and there's the potential for a dramatic change in the balance of power in Congress in every 2 years. And when you have that kind of turnover in leadership, or that kind of potential for turnover in leadership, it's very difficult to have any kind of consistent policy over time. And one of the things I think that you've argued is that as far as coming up with a good energy policy, you can't be changing your direction every couple of years.
Well, this is very important. You know, the Congress was designed our system of government was designed to be good at incremental, small incremental changes, but not very good at important long-term policies. And energy policy has proved that design feature to be absolutely true. And the difficulty is that large investments in creating energy, whether it's nuclear power plants or natural gas drilling or energy efficiency, improving a building so that it uses less energy, all of these are long-term investments. And the difficulty is that there has been no mechanism that the Congress has come up with to ensure that our policies over the long term make sense. And as you suggest, when Congress changes or when the administration changes, the priorities change. We've seen that most recently when George Bush of Texas was replaced by Barack Obama, and the emphasis shifted from oil and natural gas, which are important in Texas, to Barack Obama's intense interest in what he calls green energy.
Mm. Well, does that come under the head? You said earlier that maybe one of the problems is that particular presidents put the emphasis in on one thing, that they thought, here's the thing that's going to solve our problem. And as you mentioned, for in the Nixon administration, that was the big push for developing breeder reactors. And during the Carter administration, the thing was synthetic fuels, which was involved making liquid transportation fuel from coal. So the Obama administration, their thing is green energy and renewables and trying to develop those industries. And they say, and then that's the thing that is has the potential for dealing with our concerns over global climate and lessening our dependence on imported oil and maybe our dependence on fossil fuels altogether. Is that as much of a as much in the way of wishful thinking, do you think, as some of the things that previous administrations have advocated?
Well, David, I do think a lot of it is wishful thinking. I do not think that we're going to be able to rely on wind and solar power in particular to provide the kinds of levels of electricity production that President Obama has urged. I also think, frankly, that he's overstated dramatically the potential for green energy to revive the economy. The jobs in green energy, many of them, particularly things like production of wind turbines, are located in Asia. So there are companies, for example, that are installing wind turbines in the U.S. and that are designing wind turbines, but they're producing them in places like Malaysia. And so I do think in some ways that President Obama has fallen victim to the same idea of let's explain to the American people one silver bullet that's going to solve this energy problem. And what we really need is a quiver full of many different arrows, and we need to be looking in a number of directions.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Michael Goretz. He is professor of law at Columbia University. He's also emeritus professor of law at Yale and is author of a recent book. It's titled The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. It's published by the MIT Press. It takes a look at the various sources of energy on which we depend in this country and how it is and why it is that over time we just have not been able to put together an effective, coherent, consistent energy policy in this country. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, there is one other thing in the way of a general point, but I think it's a very important one that you make and goes to this question of, well, how do we approach best energy? The problem, I think one of your bottom line issues is that no matter who it is that's making the policy, we have this tendency toward making policy that promises all gain and no pain. That is, no one has to suffer, no one has to lose, no person, no industry. We don't want industries to lose money. People don't like paying taxes. They don't like to have to ration their energy use. And it does seem that we keep in our addressing this, we don't really come to grips with the fact that you can't do it that way, that if you're going to change things fundamentally, that there will be a price to be paid, and it'll pinch. And it's something that we're just going to have to get used to.
Well, I think that's right, David. As you know, I argue that that we should be paying the full price of our energy, which includes the price of tension and in fact, war in the Middle East, and the pollution and health hazards that things like coal have caused us. And we've always tried to subsidize those energy products, or we've just used the general revenues of the Treasury. And so, I mean, I think oil is a perfectly good example. We think that oil is extremely expensive, but needless to say, it does not cover the costs of the Persian fleet in keeping the Straits of Hormuz open so that we make sure that the oil is coming from the Middle East to the Louisiana ports where it arrives. It doesn't. We don't begin to pay the price of, you know, what we're now doing in Libya in our energy costs. We're paying it by borrowing or through general taxes, but we're not paying it in terms of energy. And I do think that if oil were required to pay its fair price, and if coal were required to pay its full price, the prices of energy would have been higher, and that they should have been higher, particularly if you think, as I do, that one of the real opportunities that we have going ahead is to find ways to use less energy to produce the same kind of economic output that we're now producing. We've gotten better at it, but we could get a lot better than we have.
Mm-hmm. And your argument would be both for, if you're interested in trying to promote energy efficiency, that perhaps the best way to do that, both for if you're talking about individuals or perhaps if you're talking about industry, is to make energy more expensive.
Well, that's right. And what's interesting about it, David, is that we do make it more expensive, but we don't. We have this anti-tax disease, our tax phobia. So we won't do it in the form of taxing petroleum products more or any such thing, but instead we regulate. And if I could give you one important example of that. So one of the successes that people point to of energy policy in the 1970s are the so-called CAFE fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. But there have been a number of economic studies that show that by regulating the efficiency of cars, and particularly doing it the way we did it, which required all the companies to produce an average fuel economy so that Chrysler had to make small cars, and it turns out that the Japanese, who had an advantage in the 1970s in small cars, found that they could make large cars and be well within those requirements. We wasted an awful lot of resources and money through those standards, and one estimate is that we could have gotten much more fuel efficiency with a 25 cents a gallon tax on gasoline. And it would have occurred in a way that the market would have decided which cars Chrysler made, and their efficiencies, their own efficiencies, would have been taken highest advantage of, and probably the Japanese wouldn't have gotten into the luxury car market the way they have. So that what we do is we do it through regulation or we do it through subsidies. We've also had a lot of subsidies in the energy area for everything from oil to wind energy now. Or even installing storm windows. So we're perfectly prepared to subsidize and spend money at the government level, and we're perfectly prepared to regulate But the one thing that we're completely unwilling to do is to impose a tax. And I've argued that we ought to tax something like energy production, particularly coal and oil and gas production that we want to use less of, and use the money that we'd get from that to reduce taxes on wages or jobs that we want more of. There's a lot of sensible things we could do if we just had the political will to do them.
So I have a caller, sure, I get right to you, but I want to underscore that point that you're saying that raising taxes in one area does not necessarily mean in the aggregate all taxes are going up.
No, there's no, you know, we can get whatever revenue we need from the government, but we ought to be more sensible in our tax policy and tax those things we want to use less of. And then tax less those things that we want more of, like wages. So mm-hmm. we could substitute a gas tax for the payroll tax. It would be a great advantage to the country.
All right. We have some callers. Let us talk with them. Spring Bay is the first. Line 4, this is our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I read a post last week titled Deus Ex Machina, and the argument was that the economic and political will is lacking in energy policy, and that with global climate change, Jim Hansen from NASA said it's more advanced than we previously thought, that what's going to happen or what needs to happen or what will happen is economic collapse in order eventually to save the species from climate change. I hear you talking about policies and efficiencies, but the scale is always the bugaboo on that. And so I just thought I'd throw that sort of nihilistic report out there and let you comment on it, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, what do you think?
Well, I think climate change is very important. It's a long-term problem, David, so it feeds right into our earlier discussion about our difficulty as a nation in mobilizing our political ability to respond to long-term challenges. It's not right around the corner, but it is, I think, as the reader suggests, and certainly as Jim Hansen and others who've studied it suggest, it's one of those problems that when it hits, it'll be too late to reverse it, and we'll be paying major costs. So I do think we ought to be thinking seriously, more seriously than we are about climate change. What's interesting about climate change is that it is an international problem. It's a world problem. And we have enough trouble dealing with our national interests. We have not, as I argue in my book and go through 40 years of energy policy in every possible energy domain, we have not made sensible policy in our own American self-interests. When you say that you've got to respond to something like climate change, which involves a worldwide problem, and particularly a worldwide problem at a time when large populations are just beginning to move from a developing world economy into a more developed economy and are interested in improving their standards of living. And here I'm talking about places like China and India in particular, where you can expect the energy consumption to go way up over time. You know, we've not had great success in working through the United Nations climate change process. And we're going to have to find more creative international ways of doing that. But again, as you know, in our own Congress, there are people who basically insist that climate change is an idea that was ginned up by some left-wing group to take over the government or to make the government interfere in your life. And this, I think, is nonsense, but it is nonsense that seems to be taking hold, at least in certain quarters, particularly in the Republican Party.
Mm. Well, I want to go on to – perhaps we'll come back to the basic question, but I want to go on to some other callers here, particularly someone we have here on the cell phone. This is line 1. Hello.
Yes, two things. The raising the price of energy and lowering consumption, and what that does to the lower classes who cannot drive, who cannot heat their homes, and so forth. If that becomes the process of doing things to change energy consumption, what then are those people at the bottom going to do? And the other thing about an idea of, that is around about solar and wind and the monstrosities I see in northern Illinois and in Indiana of wind farms. I mean, these things are growing like static trees. And how many of those would it take to provide the wind energy and the population growth around the world? And as you've just said about the China, India, each having over a billion people and living a Western lifestyle, I think is the, in my opinion, is not an answer. The only thing that is the answer is population control. Thank you.
Well, I particularly want you to speak to the first point that the caller made, because I'm sure that there are some people who indeed would make that argument that if we make energy more expensive, that what we are in effect doing is instituting a kind of regressive tax that will indeed fall most heavily on low-income people and will make their lives even more difficult.
Well, I'm certainly not a person who wants to make the lives of lower and middle-income Americans more difficult. It is the case that energy taxes or increased prices on energy are regressive if you don't make some offsets to address that problem. The poor and the middle class are bearing the burden of increased oil prices right now because of the it started with the Libyan crisis, and it does hit those folks. The problem is that at the moment, the money that they're spending is basically going out of the country to our suppliers, who are not necessarily our friends. And if we did it in the form of taxes, we would have the opportunity to offset those costs and alleviate that regressivity. There are lots of ways to do it. The reason I suggest relieving payroll taxes is that the payroll tax is also regressive. And so you can substitute one regressive tax for another and not really change the burden on poor and middle-income folks. Mm-hmm. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, which I think is the most effective advocate in Washington for the lower income groups, for moderate and low-income folks, worked out a way of delivering some of the revenues from something like a carbon tax, if you were going to impose such a tax, to low- and middle-income people to eliminate the regressivity. And so I just want to be clear that my view is, like the callers, that we want to be sure that if we're going to do this, we're going to do it in a way that protects the well-being of low- and middle-income folks in the country. Hmm. That's why I say give it back in the form of reduced taxes or give it back in the form of increased payments to those groups. The earned income tax credit could be increased, for example. There are lots of ways to do this, but it needs to be done. It needs to be part of the package. So I agree with the caller about that, particularly.
All right. We are at a point here we need to pause. We're talking with Michael Gretz about energy policy in the United States, the subject of his book, The End of Energy. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Michael Gretz. He is a professor of law at Columbia University. He's also emeritus professor of law at Yale and is a specialist in the area of tax law. He is the author of a recently published book that is titled The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. It is published by the MIT Press. Questions are welcome, and we have some other folks here. Next caller is in Charleston, and this would be line two. Hello.
Yeah, I have a question about, you know, like the energy. And I think we're, if you look at most of our energy consumption, you know, like oil, gas, I would have to say the majority of that is used in commuting to work. And that is because people choose not to live in the towns next to their jobs, but they choose to live, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more miles away from work and rather just commute that. And what I would suggest, you know, suggest is pay that $200 or $300 a month extra in rent or your mortgage and be home in like 15 minutes instead of spending hours and hours a day on the roads, because what happens is you're spending all that money at the gas pump, and as many would know, cars are not cheap to get repaired. You know, every, like a little sensor goes out, that's many hundreds of dollars for every little repair like that. And also the many man hours on the road, and when you have so much traffic, which, you know, gets worse and worse, your travel efficiency, you know, that could be 80-90% efficient, is going down to 10-20% because you're just standing and crawling in traffic for hours trying to get home.
Well, you, Professor Gretz, you have some thought about just how much of how big a piece of all of this is essentially it's liquid transportation fuel. It's fuel that's used in personal transportation, so we're talking about individual cars and people going wherever it is they go, whether that's between work and home or wherever it is that they go.
Well, I think the caller is onto something when he talks about the fact that we drive greater distances between home and work than most of the other folks around the world. We were able to move to the suburbs and then the exurbs because We both failed to pay for the cost of gasoline. This is my earlier point. If gasoline were as expensive here as it would be if it were bearing its full costs, then people would have been a little more reluctant, I think, to move that far away, and certainly would have bought more fuel-efficient automobiles over time. So we are doing that, and it causes pollution. It causes pollution in the cities. It causes congestion on the highways. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time and have been out there recently, and the commuting times have greatly increased because the congestion is higher and the distances people are traveling is definitely higher. So it's clear that our lifestyle has developed that way, and there are lots of stories and reasons for it. One is that the automobile industry in its early days, along with some others, was very anxious to eliminate mass transit and to hinder mass transit, so that you had trolley lines, for example, from downtown Los Angeles to the beach in Santa Monica that were pulled up and replaced by highways. And so we've made lots of those decisions over time that are certainly costly to folks in terms of their commutes. But I don't think we're going to change the way we're living, nor do I think we necessarily should. I just think that we need to stop paying for oil and gasoline in the form of the lives and limbs of people who are fighting for us in the Middle East, and we need to stop having our foreign policies held hostage to our need for foreign oil. And it would have been a very different world, for example, if Jimmy Carter had been successful. He proposed, for example, a nickel a gallon increase in the gas tax each year beginning in 1979. It would have come in gradually. We would have not had a big economic shock as a result of that. And we would, I think there would be more people living closer to their jobs and commuting less distances and so forth. So I do think we would have, we clearly would save energy use if we were, as I say, bearing the full cost of the energy we consume.
Yeah. So the big section of the book is devoted to talking about oil and how the politics in the Middle East changed things and how that started to change in the 1970s, looking at the time when most of our need, or at least, I guess, two-thirds of the oil that we use in the United States was domestic, whereas now it's less than half. And something that's just really very striking is you mentioned in the book that in the summer of 1971, a barrel of oil sold for about $3. And that the last time I checked, it was over a little bit over 90, and that was actually down from historic highs. So the cost of the basic product has changed tremendously, and that's sort of gone up and down. And depending on what's happening with the price, we either get more serious about efficiency or not. But it does seem that overall, we still haven't changed very much in our expectation that we should be able to go to the pump, fill up the car, and go where we want to go when. We complain, but I don't know how much people are altering their basic habits.
Well, I think that's right, because they've seen that when the price spikes, which it did a few years back and has again recently, that it tends to come back down. And so they don't think that they're going to make a change that's going to be a long-term change. And when you think about automobile purchases, this goes back to my earlier point in the hour, you know, you decide to buy a car, it's a long-term purchase. Most people keep a car 3 or 4 years at least. I keep them a lot longer than that. And, you know, if you're going to buy one when gasoline is at $4.50 a gallon, you're going to be much more concerned about energy efficiency than you are if you buy it when gasoline is $2.50 a gallon. Mm-hmm. And we certainly take it for granted that we're going to go to the pump and we're going to fill up our car with gas. There's not going to be a shortage. We did have shortages in the 1970s. We had major gas lines. We had odd, even gas station days. If your license plate ended with an odd number, you could only fill up on odd days. And if it ended with an even number, you could only fill up on the opposite days. Those days are not even in the memory of most Americans these days. And so we take it for granted. And, you know, we're sending $500 million a day overseas. It's going to countries that are not all necessarily friendly to us. Many of them now have sovereign wealth funds so that they're buying up assets around the world, including a lot of American assets. And it's just a very crazy policy situation that we've gotten ourselves into. And going through the lessons and mistakes that we began to make in the 1970s, which is when energy policy really first came to the fore in America, should, as I suggest in the book, give us a sense of how to avoid those mistakes going forward. But there's certainly very little, David, on the political horizon that would give you confidence that the future is going to be much much more sensible than the past.
Let us talk with some more callers. And next up will be someone in Homer, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. My name is Stan, and I'm just amazed at what I'm hearing here. I mean, if this guest, and I apologize for not remembering the name, if this guest's desire is to end payroll taxes with another regressive tax, the Republicans have been wanting to end Social Security since 1935, for God's sakes, and this is just another way to move in that direction. This is craziness. If we're going to move towards ending Social Security and all the other safety nets for people of modest means, like the Republicans and the conservatives want to, and if this comment that your guest made about ending payroll taxes with some sort of oil tax because they're both regressive taxes, and oh my goodness, it's all okay to do that. Man, if that's something that's out of this book, I highly do not recommend that anybody read this book.
Well, Professor Gratz?
Well, you know, I appreciate the call, but Stan
you want
is
me to stay on the line.
Yeah, well, hold it. Yeah, hold on. I want to give the guest a chance to respond. Go ahead, Professor Gratz.
I mean, okay. I have you know, a long history of working on Social Security. And actually, I'm on the board of the National Academy of Social Insurance, which is probably the organization that has defended Social Security the most vigorously. And has suggested increases in Social Security benefits for the poor over a long time. And so I suggest that that connection is certainly not one that I'm urging. I'm not in the end a Social Security camp. I think that you can increase the trust fund in a whole series of ways. But that's a whole nother conversation. The question that I'm really raising, and, you know, if he wants to do something else with the money, if he wants to increase Social Security benefits for low-income people or whatever Stan wants to do with the money, is fine with me. My point is really, at least in this context, about energy policy. And while it's true that spending money on gasoline is a problem of poor and middle-class people as well as higher-income people, and we have to be attentive that we don't increase burdens on people who are struggling already, a point I made earlier, that's really not what this particular book is about. I have another book I wrote a while ago on Social Security that I would recommend to Stan. But that's really not what we're talking about. And the problem is that you can't say, well, we've got to save Social Security, so let's not do anything about energy policy. You've got to be able to do two things at once.
Hmm. Just I guess I can give the caller a quick follow-up if you'd like.
Well, I agree that we need to be able to do more than one thing at a time. But as I said, the Republicans have been wanting to do away with Social Security since 1935. I'm extremely disappointed in Obama for having reduced the payroll taxes by 2%, because I think that is just the camel's nose under the tent for their desire to end Social Security. And the more we put that thought on the table, that is the definition of disaster capitalism. You keep these thoughts on the table that if we can do this, then we can end Social Security payroll taxes. You are going down the wrong road, and I think that that will be a disastrous thing for what used to be middle-class America, which has almost been destroyed already by the policies of the conservatives. Let me just throw one other thing out, and that is the fact that you say all presidents are sort of equally responsible for our energy situation today. And I disagree with you there as well, because Reagan was the one that dismantled all of the things that Jimmy Carter tried to put in place to make the United States energy independent, and he pushed us back to the 1960s and total oil.
Well, we're getting kind of short on time, but I'd like to have Professor Gratz respond specifically to that point.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that they're all equally responsible. Jimmy Carter certainly tried to do more about energy than most of the eight presidents between Nixon and Obama. But I think the history is a bit wrong on Reagan as well. Reagan actually was responsible for deregulating oil and gasoline prices, and gas, natural gas prices. We had had regulation of natural gas prices for years, and until the deregulation of natural gas and the fact that the explorers for natural gas were able to believe that they wouldn't face regulated prices, that then led to a lot of exploration, a lot of technology development in the natural gas area, and we now have discovered in these shale deposits, a huge domestic supply of natural gas, which gives us a much cleaner fuel for our electricity. It produces half of the greenhouse gases of coal. We could be much better off if we substituted natural gas turbines for every coal-fired electric plant in the country. And so, I wouldn't pick on Reagan exactly the way that the caller has either. It's a very complicated subject, and, each one of them has said, we must end our addiction to Middle East oil. That's the one thing they all have in common, and all of them have failed. And the question that I'm really trying to get people to focus on in this book that I've written is to address the question, why have we failed? What is it we can ask of our politicians so that in 2050, 40 years from now, my children and grandchildren are not looking back at this period of time and saying, well, they did absolutely no better during the period from 2010 to 2050 than the nation did from 1970 to 2010. And that's really the concern I have. It's just as much a mistake on the left to try and mix up this problem with regressivity or, the environmental problems. I'm surprised we haven't had callers telling me that, I'm anti-environment as well as wanting to put the elderly poor back on the streets, neither one of which I am. But, there are lots of ways to distract us from this serious problem, and we've been distracted, misled, and inadequately served for 40 years. And my fear is that we're going to look back 40 years from now, not I, maybe not you, David, but for our children, and they're going to say, well, you didn't do any better.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Michael Gretz. He teaches law at Columbia University, and we have some other callers. We'll try to do at least one more, and that person is in Chicago, line three. Hello.
Hello. I have a comment on the use of food for energy. I don't see the wisdom of the current policy of subsidizing ethanol and, driving the food prices so high and the effect that would have on the on the poor people around the world. And what's the guest's thoughts on that?
Well, it's crazy policy. The ethanol policy has been crazy in the United States for years. Not only do we subsidize corn used for ethanol in a way that deflects it from food and increases food prices, but we also have a tariff on ethanol from imported from Brazil. Where they're using sugarcane for their ethanol, so we're not even allowing that to come into the country at a reasonable price, and so it's an example of Iowa politics. But what's happened is because Iowa has played such an important role in presidential elections, is that every presidential candidate who becomes serious in Iowa has embraced ethanol subsidies over the years. Now, I think we're on the verge of getting rid of them, so I'm hopeful that we might get rid of them, but we've known them to be bad, wasteful policy for at least 25 years, and we haven't gotten rid of them as of the day.
Let me give you an opportunity to just make some more people mad here for about a minute or so left, because you also, in the book, have some criticism for the environmental movement. You think that in some, maybe with good intentions, that they've actually been, at some points, counterproductive?
Well, I do. I think they were, particularly in the 1970s, the environmental movement, I mean, somebody, one of your earlier callers mentioned that the solution was population control, where there was a big, small is beautiful, zero population growth movement that took place in the 70s. The environmentalists certainly played a key role in halting nuclear power construction in the U.S. after Three Mile Island. Really were unwilling to allow solar energy and even wind energy to go anywhere near scale. So the idea was that people like Barry Commoner and the like, well-known environmentalists, would suggest that we should have a solar panel on every street lamp rather than having a whole series of solar panels that were going to produce electricity at the source and be delivered to us. So I do fault the environmental movement, and if you look today, I think the environmental movement is in danger of increasing beyond what is necessary, the regulation and the costs of natural gas in the United States. There are allegations about its effect on drinking water. There are some other studies that seem to me to be overblown. Now, it's not to say that there are not serious safety and environmental issues when you are in the energy business, but and we've seen from the deep water drilling disaster in the Gulf and the Massey mine explosion in West Virginia in recent years, that every form of energy is dangerous, and we need to be careful, you know, not to put nuclear power plants in the way of tsunamis and on earthquake faults. But we also need to be reasonable in finding a path that allows us to protect the environment, but at the same time to produce the energy that we need. The one place where the environmentalists, I think, could be extremely helpful and have been to some extent, could be more helpful, is in promoting energy efficiency.
Mm. I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that we will get back to these issues other days, other guests, but for the moment, we have to stop there as we've used our time. Our guest, Michael Gretz, is a professor of law at Columbia University, also emeritus professor of law at Yale. If you'd like to read his book, it's titled The End of Energy, and it is published by the MIT Press. And we want to thank you very much, Professor, for giving us some of your time.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
And also want to say thanks to the technical director, Nancy Goldfarb. She's on the other end of our high-quality connection here with folks at Columbia University.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
Everyone should be educated.
And this entrepreneur put his money where his mouth is. He created a free online university for poor students around the globe.
I care about the people who don't have the right for education right now, and they should have the right.
But is the school sustainable?
How are we going to make this work while keeping it tuition free?
The University of the People, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana with beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, and for those with or recovering from cancer. New classes start the week of August 27th. Details at yoga-cu.com. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit of Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session for the pit trade. Futures are pairing what we saw in the electronic grain overnight gains as light profit-taking is putting soybeans, wheat, and corn under pressure. Traders cautious, pushing prices maybe too much higher with fresh corn and soybean entering the supply, even though the market has now factored in what is going to be a significantly smaller crop, both in corn and in soybeans. Traders are often also taking a little bit of a wait-and-see attitude today as we continue to monitor the path of Tropical Storm Isaac. and what its potential impact on grain and oilseed markets might be, depending on the rain and the amounts thereof emerging from that storm. It could disrupt some harvest operations in the Delta, as well as slow transportation of crops being moved to export locations in the Gulf, as well as offloading from the Gulf into the foreign market. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. Currently, right now in Kansas City, September wheat at 873.5, down 2.75. September wheat in Chicago at 862, down 5.5. September corn, 7.